When Kimberlia Durant was 17 years old, she signed up for military service. Her father thought it was a good idea, but Kimberlia wasn't so sure.
When the recruiter came to get me, I looked at my mom and I said, "Mama, I'm not sure about this anymore." I said, "I don't know. I think I might be making a mistake here." And she said, "Well, if you feel you're making a mistake, go get back in the bed. Now just tell him you're not going." I said, "No, I'm going to go ahead. I'm going to do this." Because my father was behind her, shaking his head like, "Don't you even try it."
Kimberlia Durant was posted to Egypt as an army specialist with the multinational force and observers to help keep peace in the Middle East. She was 20 years old when she was raped by a fellow soldier. But she kept that secret from her family, from her own mother, for another 17 years.
One day she finally asked me what went wrong. And she put it, I was her kid with so much promise. And I told her, "I got raped."
Kimberlia Durant says she kept her secret too long. She says other women who get assaulted in the military shouldn't make that same mistake. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Military statistics for the past couple of years show that each year, close to 3,000 women in the armed forces report a sexual assault. And that's just the number that are reported. It's easy to see why women soldiers are reluctant to tell their stories. Nearly half the cases that are reported result in no disciplinary action. None. Today I'm talking with the former Army specialist, Kimberlia Durant. I've asked her to tell me her story, and some of the language used here is a little raw, but so are her memories of what happened. Kimberlia says she remembers joining the Army, and she remembers being happy to be in basic training.
I was all of about 90 pounds, and I think you had to be about 93, 94 pounds to go to basic training, and I just couldn't gain those 3 pounds. So I stayed at the holdover station for about 5 weeks, and then I went to basic training. Basic training went great. I was in love with the military, the discipline. I was really good at it.
What was the mix of men and women?
We were segregated. The men were on one side of the hill. The women were on the other side of the hill, and we weren't allowed to talk. They considered it fraternization.
How was it for the women? Were you guys treated with respect?
No, not at all. Respect was something you had to earn. I remember vividly when we got to basic training, they took all of our underwear. All the women's underwear, they took all of our bras and all of our panties, and they put us in boxers and sports bras. You were only allowed to wear female underwear during your monthly. Otherwise, you needed to have on boxers. You were little boys, and when the drill sergeants were finished, you would be grown men.
This was coming from the drill sergeants. This wasn't just someone teasing you.
No, this was coming from the drill sergeants. Female was a derogatory term from the door. You did not want to be called a female. A female was someone who was weak. I have several old diaries, and I was looking through one of them, and I had written something about one of the people in my platoon must have done something. And I was like, I wish she stopped acting like a damn female. You did not want to be a female at all. You didn't want to be a woman. You wanted to be a grown man.
But, I mean, how would they enforce something like the underwear rule, for example?
The green camouflage that everyone wears,
yeah.
It fits a certain way, depending on what undergarments you have on. And if the female drill sergeant, you know, questioned the way it fits, she would like, "Come over here, come over here. Open up," and you would have to open your pants and show them.
Okay, this is stranger than I thought it was. This is coming from female drill sergeants, right? Not male drill sergeants.
Female and male drill sergeants. Yeah. Even the female drill sergeants didn't want to be called females. You need to be a soldier at all times. If you weren't a soldier, you needed to act like you were a grown man. But the males were very scared of the fraternization laws.
Yeah.
I can only speak for the unit that I was with, but that's exactly how they were.
Kimberlia Durant says she thought she fit in. She embraced the military mentality. She and other women in her unit began to believe that they were tougher than other women in uniform.
We were looking at the other females like, what the hell is wrong with her? Females were very feminine, and we were like, huh? You mean to tell me everybody wasn't trained like us? It was really a surprise for us. We were the females that they put into leadership positions. We were the females that were allotted a lot of different things. It was almost like we got a higher level of respect because we were so hard. I think that in their minds, they were really just trying to make us tougher. They wanted to strip you of everything and rebuild you. The head drill sergeant told us he would teach us how to feel, he would teach us how to think, and he would teach us how to act. And those of us that acted like sponges, like myself, we soaked all of that up. If you were a pretty girl, you were okay. If you were not, they treated you like a guy, like one of the boys.
Tell me something else, Kimberly. Were there married women as well as single women who were going through basic training with you?
Yes.
And were they treated differently, married versus single?
I didn't notice the difference in being married or single in the military until I got to my first duty station, which was Sinai, Egypt. It was 900 men and maybe 10 women, no more than 20 women. Single women were all whores. And especially if you spoke to other guys and you were the kind of girl that could sit down and play cards with the guys or whatever, you were definitely a slut. The married women were treated with so much more respect. They were allotted so much more leeway than the single women like myself were.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Kimberly Durant says that posting in Egypt was a high-profile one. She was with the multinational force and observers put in place to help smooth relations between Egypt and Israel. Even then, the Gaza Strip was the regional tinderbox.
It was extraordinarily violent over there. We were supposed to be the peacekeeping force between Israel and Egypt.
And in this South Camp, Kimberly, would you have been serving primarily with other Americans, or was it a real mix of people from all over the world?
It was a real mix of people from all over the world. It just weren't any women. The only women that were there were American women.
And how many of them would have been your age, which is what, at the time, maybe 18, 19 years old?
Two, myself and another female. All the other women were in their late 20s, early 30s.
And did anyone reach out to you? Did anyone say, you know, look, if you've got issues, if you have questions, you know that my tent is open, you can chat with me. Did any of that happen?
Yes. I had a female sergeant, late 20s, and the day I got there, she said to me, listen, I hate to tell you this. She said, it's your first time away from home. I said, yes. She said, you're on your own. She said, nobody's going to help you around here. She said, your best bet is to depend on yourself. But if you want to talk, you can talk to me. But she didn't stay long. Within 30 days, maybe 60 days of that, she was gone because she had rotated out.
Yeah.
Myself and the other young lady, for some reason, we did not bond. She ended up working in one place. I ended up working in another. And even though we stayed in the same trailer, we very rarely dealt with each other.
Kimberly Durant says the absence of other young women her own age didn't bother her initially. And one day she asked a favor of a male soldier.
I went to another American soldier's room to get a music tape from him. And when he let me in to get the tape and he assaulted me, I got raped. Right after it happened, I think I must have sat on my bed for a couple of hours trying to figure what in the hell just happened to me. I barricaded myself in my room for a while. I stayed there. And all of a sudden, I just felt real, real dirty, and I ran in the bathroom and I showered. I just stood there in the shower crying and scrubbing myself. The next day, I didn't go to the formation, and that's what made them come to see where I was. My platoon sergeant, he came to see me, and I'm trying to explain it to him. He was very sympathetic. He was, at least in front of me, he acted enraged. He could not believe it, like that someone would do that. He didn't doubt me. He just was disgusted by it. He told me he was going to go take it to the first sergeant and that I could sit in my room for however long I needed and that he would, talk to them for me. I don't know what was said to him in that office, but by the next time I saw him, he couldn't even look me in my face. He had nothing to say.
But did anybody come to take a statement from you? Did anybody come to do a medical exam? Was any of that? So we take that for granted now. But I mean,
no, none of that. My lieutenant came by. He was like, "Well, why'd you take a shower? What did you get washed for?" And he told me that I shouldn't make America look bad, and that maybe I just got things twisted, and that if I wanted to make E3, I would be quiet. I would get myself together and stop acting like a damn baby.
This is what your lieutenant told you?
Yeah. I asked the lieutenant, what was I supposed to do? And he told me that maybe it was because I was so young that I didn't realize that by going to that young man's room, maybe I might have said something. What he was trying to get me to understand was that I might have brought this on myself somehow, and that I would make America and my unit look really bad if this got out. So his suggestion was that I just kept quiet.
And what did you think about that?
At the time, I didn't know what to think. I sat there looking at him like, wow, okay, this is my fault. This is what they're telling me. This is my fault. And I started to doubt myself. I was like, well, maybe I did something, you know? Maybe I did do something. And when he left, I just sat there. I just went real numb for a while. Just really numb.
Kimberly Durand eventually tried to press the case for her rights, but she found that the military had closed her off. Her superiors called her stupid and suggested that she had invited the assault. She became so unsure of herself that she kept the whole matter secret from her own family for the next 17 years. I'll talk further with Kimberly Durand in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Army Specialist Kimberly Durand was sexually assaulted by a fellow soldier when she was posted overseas. Now, this happened back in 1990. It would be another 15 years before the Department of Defense would even open up its sexual assault and response office. And this past year, over 20% of women soldiers serving said they too were sexually assaulted. Kimberly says she found no one in the military or in the VA who would talk to her about her case. She says she felt let down because she comes from a family with a strong military tradition.
My brother, my father, my aunt, uncle ran an army family. My mother had 6 kids, and college money just wasn't there. So just around, I'll say, about May when I graduated. So I was like, you know, I can go in the army and get a college fund. Who knows, I might stay, I might do 20. Because, well, my Aunt Geneva, she was the only female to do 20 years in my family. So I was like, oh, I'll be like her and see how it works. Right after I graduated, maybe a week later, I went into the military.
What did your mother think about your going into the military? Was she behind you on this?
She didn't like it. She didn't like it at all. She wanted me to go directly to school. She wanted me to go to law school. But she was like, no, that's going to delay law school. But if that's what you want to do, go ahead. And that's what I did. My father, he was all for it. He was very happy.
And what about you? Were you having second thoughts, or did you think like this was, you know, exactly the thing that you wanted to do? What were your thoughts?
I was all for it. The day of is when I had the first of a couple of incidents where it was, you know, maybe I'm making a mistake here. When the recruiter came to get me, I looked at my mom and I said, Mama, I'm not sure about this anymore. I said, I don't know. I think I might be making a mistake here. And she said, well, if you feel you're making a mistake, go get back in the bed. Now just tell him you're not going. And I said, no, I'm going to go ahead. I'm going to do this. Because my father was behind her, shaking his head like, don't you even try it. And I was like, no, I'm going to go ahead. Because my father was like, no, you're going. There was no verbal. His mouth was just moving, "You're going, you're going." He told me actually on the elevator on the way down, he hugged me and he said, "You're doing what you're supposed to do for once." And we both kind of laughed. So.
It sounds like you were getting some conflicting advice here.
Yeah. My mom didn't like it. Like I said, she wanted me to go to law school. I was supposed to be the lawyer. And my father felt that it would be good for me as far as discipline-wise because I was a little bit of a wild child. So I fought a lot in high school, in junior high school. Mouth off. I was the kid that was always into something. My parents, they were hard on me, but if they weren't around, I sure would try to do whatever it was I could. My sisters were prissy and primmy and proper, and I was sneakers and jeans and running around with the guys acting stupid. He really felt like I should grow out of that and become a little lady, and I just wasn't ready for that.
Kimberly Durant liked the military rules and discipline, which is why she felt so confused about the way the military tried to shut her down after she was sexually assaulted. She was young, just 20, and she was being told by the investigating officer that she should keep quiet if she wanted to make rank.
I needed to get promoted because I knew my mother was struggling at home and she needed more money. They held my E3 promotion over my head till almost a month before I left there. I was soldier of the month. I should have gotten E3 the minute I got soldier of the month. But between making soldier of the month and what would have been an automatic promotion, I got raped. So they kept it. So I just figured I'd let it go. And I would be okay. I didn't say anything.
Kimberly Durant had to stay on at the Multinational Forces and Observers Camp in Egypt after she was raped. She says the time after the assault was awful. She was called a number of foul names. She repeats them here.
Life changed severely after the incident. None of the male soldiers would speak. They were scared that I might accuse them of raping me. The female soldiers basically heckled me. I couldn't do anything right. I was a dumbass Durant.
I don't understand. What did the female soldiers say? Why wouldn't they support you?
It's like I said, if you were a single female, you were a whore there. So obviously I must have asked for it or something. Or one particular sergeant said, "Stop putting yourself in damn predicaments." We had a barrack meeting and she didn't say my name. She never mentioned me. But I knew she was talking about me. She said, "You damn females need to realize that you keep putting yourself in predicaments and then you want to cry when things happen to you. You ain't got no damn business in the men's barracks for nothing. You stay outside the door, because once you go in, whatever happened to you, you're on your damn own." The other contingents were nice, but God, those Americans were some nasty people.
The other contingents, you mean the soldiers from other countries?
Yeah.
What did they do for you?
They were like, "Are you okay?" They would walk me from my barrack to my job. They were always around me. You know, if I was outside, they were somewhere close.
And so the word that had gone around South Camp was that Kimberly Durant had been raped, and they were responding to you that way.
It was Kimberly gave him some and changed her mind, and now she's trying to call rape. They made it seem as if I just fabricated the whole damn thing.
What about the platoon sergeant, the first guy who talked to you, the guy who was sympathetic?
He wouldn't even look me in my face. He wouldn't even talk to me after that. None of them would. If I went to the mess hall to get something to eat, I sat by myself. Because if I sat down, everybody moved. I don't know if anybody can imagine what it's like to have it be you against the whole world. You say good morning and people look at you like you stole something. People treat you like you got the plague. You don't look at it as if, you know, they're just ignorant or they're just going with the pack. You go, "Damn, what did I do?"
Did you have the choice to leave the camp?
No. I had to stay there till my year was over. It was a couple of months.
And the soldier who assaulted you, was he moved off base? Was he still around?
He was still there. He came by my barrack about 3 weeks later to apologize to me because he felt that we might have got something twisted. And I started screaming at him, like, you got nerve even coming over here. And I'm screaming at him and cursing at him. And the NCO in charge of the barracks came out and was like, what happened? What's wrong? What's going on? And he said, I told you that bitch was crazy. That was the last time he spoke to me.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. At the end of her tour in Egypt, Kimberlia Durant was sent back to the U.S., sent to Fort Campbell. It wasn't much better there because some of the soldiers she'd served with in Egypt were transferred there as well.
They told everybody, so once again, they still treated me crappy. I couldn't do nothing right. I was a dumb soldier. I was a troublemaker. Even when I was right, I was wrong.
At any point along these months that came after Kimberlia, did anyone give you any advice about how you could maybe file a charge against this soldier or make a formal complaint? I mean, there must have been some part of you that was thinking about it in terms of just decency or justice, if not something like revenge, just to say, wait a second, I have a story to tell here and nobody's listening to me. Was there no way for you to do that?
I didn't see any way at that time. The one thing they taught us in basic training was that a good soldier did what they were told. You didn't ask your higher-ups questions. You did what you were told. This was the biggest mistake I ever made in my life.
You wanted out?
Badly.
And was that easy for you to leave?
I ran. I couldn't wait to leave.
What were you feeling when you finally got out, though? What was your state of mind like then? Do you remember?
Completely screwed up. There was a certain sense of release that, thank you, Father, I made it out this hellhole. But, my God, I drifted so hard after I got out. And my mother said, I don't know what happened to you in there, but, girl, you are not the same.
Didn't you tell her?
I was a mess. I didn't tell her that. My mother was not the kind of person that I could tell something like that.
And your father?
Never. My father died not knowing.
How about your Aunt Geneva? She was 20 years in the military. Could you have talked to her about this?
No. I was homeless for a couple of years. In the summer, I could stay on the street. That was okay. And in the winter, I would just stay at whoever house would let me stay.
But how did you get by? How did you make money?
Mostly sold drugs. Whatever I could do to make some money, I did. As long as it didn't include me selling my body, I did it. That went on for about 2 or 3 years. My mother found out shortly before she passed. One day she finally asked me what went wrong. And she put it, I was her kid with so much promise. And I told her, I got raped.
Years later, Kimberlia Durant says she still carried a lot of the depression and confusion with her. She eventually went to the Veterans Administration to see about finally making a formal complaint.
And they told me that because I didn't file, they couldn't prove anything ever happened to me, even though all their doctors agreed that something happened. The VA said, no, we don't have any proof.
But you had the names. You had the names of a platoon sergeant, a first sergeant.
They
you had the name
care.
Of the assaulter. You had, I mean...
They didn't care. They don't have any police documents, and I would have had to find someone that I was in the unit with to back up my story, which was the impossible task, because the whole unit turned against me after that.
And what option did you have, or do you even have today, to try and file some kind of charge against the man who assaulted you?
None. I don't have any... Time has run out. Time has run out. There's so much that I'm personally now completely and adamantly against anybody going in the military before they turn 21. Because if you were anything like I was and you just believed everything you were told and you didn't check behind those people, you lost out on a lot.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Kimberlia Durant decided to speak out when she learned that her own niece was planning to join the Army.
And I was like, there's no way in hell I will let you do that. Her mother was like, it might be good for us, it might be good for her. And I just took all my VA paperwork, which is big enough to fill a file cabinet, and I just threw it at her. I was like, this is why she can't go. I said, no way. I mean, they can't promise that nothing's going to happen to her.
How old was your niece when she wanted to join up?
18. She just graduated high school. I can guarantee her that if something happens to her then, she's going to walk around for the rest of her life wondering if she had done it differently. Would she be different? I could lay in the bed that I made, but I can't watch my niece make the same mistakes. And I talked to her for weeks on end, please don't do this. That's when a lot of my family found out what happened, because I was so angry and extremely loud. I look at her and I see a younger version of me. I see a kid with a lot of promise. And that military could ruin it all for her.
When you were arguing to keep your niece out of the military, and when you told everyone in your family what had happened to you, was that a good thing for you to finally get that secret out, to let the rest of your family know what had happened to you?
Yeah. Yeah. My older brother said he figured as much. He said, I never asked you, but I swear I knew that.
And it's your older brother's daughter who's thinking of joining the military?
That was thinking of joining. I successfully changed her mind. I'm overwhelmed with joy on that.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Kimberly Durant says telling people about what happened to her, speaking out about those memories of being sexually assaulted when she served in the Army 18 years ago, is finally allowing her to heal a bit.
And it took me a long time to get to a point where I had to realize it wasn't me. If I'm guilty for anything, I'm wrong, because when they told me to sweep it under the rug, I did that. That's the only place I was wrong.
You know, Kimberly, I was reading a news story before this conversation that talked about a VA healthcare center in L.A. where doctors apparently say 41% of female veterans they see at the clinic were victims of sexual assault. That's 41%. And that almost 30% of the women that they see at that clinic report being raped during their time in military service.
I'd say that number is kind of low. Because it's not just females. I found it since I've been going down to these different veteran meetings and stuff. There's guys that this is happening to, too. It's just that this military, the Army, anyway, they bred this culture where the male soldiers are treated as if they're almost godlike. When I got home and I went to a meeting, I sat in a room with 20 women, and every last one of them had been assaulted. And you know how many of them made a complaint? Zero. Zero.
So what is the lesson from this, Kimberly? Is the lesson that women and men can't serve together in a military?
No. The lesson is that everybody has to be accountable for themselves. You end up like me if you do nothing. The people in charge have to stop thinking of themselves and their own careers. Here it is 20 years later, and I'm just as screwed up as I was when I was 18. And it came from doing nothing.
Sounds a bit to me like you're doing something now, though.
I'm trying.
Tell me something else, though, Kimberly. Why are you choosing now to tell your story?
Because it started eating me up. I couldn't hide it anymore. It was one thing when it happened. In the years following, I could hold myself like everything was okay.
Yeah.
And in the last 5 years, it just started tearing into everything. I couldn't do anything right. Even a little girl, TJ, that I'm raising now. TJ said, you know, Mommy, I said, well, baby, after you told everybody what happened to you, you became a nicer person.
Wisdom of children, eh?
Yeah.
Well, I got to tell you, Kimberly, it's a tough, tough story, and I appreciate you taking the time to spend with me in the program today.
Thank you. Thank you for listening.
Kimberly Durant joined me from a studio in New York. Thanks to Yannick Rice-Lam and to Kendra Lee at Heart and Soul for helping connect us with Kimberly. If you have any thoughts or a story of your own that you'd like to share, you can get in touch with me through our website at thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. A couple of months back, I spoke on the program with Armega Tafari. She and her family were living in Florida, and they'd been homeless for some time. When I spoke with Armega, she and her family were squatting in an empty home that was under foreclosure proceedings. She told me that when they moved into it, the house had already been used as a crack house, and it was a mess.
My husband and I, we just prayed while we cleaned. Because to look at that house and to think that we actually had to live in it, you know, to look at the spots on the floor where the feces and the condoms and things were at, and to think that our children had to walk over that floor, we just had to clean with enough faith, you know, that the bleach would actually do its job. Once it's a crack house and they start burning that stuff in the house, it sticks to the ceilings, the interiors of the walls and things of that nature. It's smoke.
You know, one thing I don't understand, Armega, is why you bothered with this house. If it was such a mess, why didn't you just, you know, get back in the van and go look for some other place to take your family? Why go to all this trouble to clean up a place in such awful shape?
Well, as atrocious as it sounds, when you're doing something for your family, there is no limit, I think, you know, that you will go to. In comparison to the other properties that we looked at, this place was the best place for our family.
After I talked with Armega, I got a lot of mail from people who were touched by the situation that her family was in. Some saw business opportunity here. Jackie from Roxboro, North Carolina, wrote to say that the bank, which owned the property, didn't have to invest anything in cleaning this empty home to get it on the market. Would it not be an opportunity for the bank to have that property and others cleaned and perhaps occupied until such time as they could be sold? If this family cleaned other properties, this might allow the family the means to perhaps buy the house that they're in, or at least rent it. Wouldn't that be a win-win for both sides? Leslie from St. Charles, Illinois, spoke for most people when she said, "Something in Armega's voice touched me deeply. I know we're not close to where she is, but I would love to offer her and her family space in my home to live. I'd be happy to talk to anyone about it and see if there's a possibility I can help another mother in need." Well, as it turned out, Armega Tafari did get several charitable offers, though the weeks since have not been easy ones for her. I caught up with her where she's living now in Tallahassee. She told me that her family left the foreclosed home soon after we spoke.
We weren't paying any lights or any water, so naturally there's repercussions to that. Those things were stressful on a day-to-day basis.
I can imagine some people listening thinking to themselves, no rent, no mortgage, not paying for utilities. That's living stress-free.
Of course not. Every day you wake up, you know, it's like after business hours, maybe a couple of hours of peace of mind. But then it's like after 2 o'clock in the morning, that peace of mind is done because, you know, it's, you know, the same thing when you wake up.
Now, sometime after our last conversation, you had a couple of offers of alternative places to live. Tell me a little bit about what happened after you left this foreclosed home.
We had a job opportunity in Orlando, and nothing tying us down to the Miami area right away. We went for it. Unfortunately, things didn't turn out, you know, up to par there. Things wasn't... Once the guy met us, he wasn't satisfied with, I'm guessing, our appearance. And I don't think the dreadlocks was something that he was expecting, and that could have been something that persuaded him to go the other way. But I say that wholeheartedly because it's an experience that we've experienced over and over and over, but it was his business, and he wasn't obligated to do anything, really. So yeah. we just had to really just pick up and leave and continue on, because a stumbling block is a stepping stone, you know. So we just had to make a stepping stone out of that and move forward, you know.
How long did you last in Orlando then? How long were you there?
We got there on the 28th and we left on the 4th.
So less than a week, really.
He paid for us a week in the hotel. And after that week was done, we decided to leave. And we got on the road and we just looked at the map and we really just decided, you know, out of the places that we, you know, were closest to the funds that we had in our pocket, Tallahassee. We had been to Tallahassee before. I gave birth to my first child there. It's fairly inexpensive. And we left out on the 5th, which was a Saturday, and we were headed to Tallahassee and we made a stop, you know, just stop beside the road. And I actually had a miscarriage on the way to Tallahassee. And that alone kind of changed the pace of things, you know, definitely.
Are you okay?
I'm absolutely fine right now. All is well. I've had my time to heal mentally, physically, and spiritually.
Do you think the miscarriage was related to the stress of not having a home, of moving around?
I definitely associate it with the stresses, because during those times is the most vulnerable time for a fetus, you know? We were doing a lot of moving and a lot of strenuous activities as far as striving to get moved.
Did you find work in Tallahassee then?
Yes. I got in touch with some people that I knew when we were here before, and her family has an organic farm, and her mother needed someone to cook for her and to help her out with light cleaning around the house and things of that nature. She has a huge house. Mm-hmm. And my husband does the farming, you know, lots of different vegetables and things, you know.
That would suit you guys,
like,
right?
50 acres. Oh, perfect. Absolutely perfect. You know, we're vegetarians, so of course we want to be close to the foods that we're consuming, you know. So now we get to see them start and harvest from the seed to the plate, you know. We can keep track of the food that we're eating now, you know. And it's just, it's been a tremendous strength to us, because working there will allow us to keep our home. You know, it's a job, and not only is it a job, but it's a joy to be there in that environment.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Good news, a job that suits, a joy to be there, but keeping our eye on the prize, what kind of home did Armega's family find?
A 2-bedroom, 1-bath house, and it's $600 a month. It has a fairly large backyard. The entire yard is nice. We've planted vegetables on all sides and flowers. The house, Dick, it has no problems whatsoever. If you remember the last house that we were living in,
there were some horror stories with that one.
Oh, yes.
Seeing how housing has been so central to your sense of well-being for the past few months, tell me what it was like the first time you saw the house, the first time you stepped inside the door.
It was like home. It was like, yeah, we did it, you know. A sense of accomplishment the first time we seen it, because the landlord actually told us that there was another lady who had come by and who was bringing him money for the house that following Friday. And but I never thought that she would come through. I kind of knew we had the house. The children had their own room. We had our own room. A bathroom where the children could actually take a bath in the bathtub and we don't have to wear shower shoes, a shower that actually works, a toilet that you could actually, you know, things that people take for granted. Those things we gave thanks for. The kitchen cabinets are intact. They're properly installed. The water heater is on the outside of the house and not sitting in the middle of the house somewhere. The outlets, the majority of them were covered when we got there, on the outside even. The landlord, he actually was a city code enforcer, so to find that out, I was satisfied before I seen the inside of the house when I talked to him, you know. Just to hear that, I was like, okay, good. And then he said $600 a month for a 2-bedroom, 1-bath. Okay, beyond good, perfect.
No chance of spontaneous fires this time, maybe?
Absolutely not.
For someone who has been so unsettled for so long, with apartments that didn't work out and squatting in a foreclosed home and that sort of thing, Can you put into words what difference it makes to your sense of well-being, to your sense of family, to have a place that you call your own, to know that it's going to be there at the end of each day and when you wake up in the morning?
When you get a house, you want to decorate your house with plants, put up nice matching shower curtain with your pots and pans for your kitchen. These things, you know, we're just to be able to walk out of the house and lock the door with the key and know that when we come back, we're going to turn this lock and it's not going to be locked. You know, it's not like nobody's going to come and put a lock on here and we won't be able to gain entry again. Definitely more comfort, peace of mind to be able to get up in the morning and fix the children breakfast and not have to rush out of the house because we don't know if the bank is coming or, you know, to get up and, you know, actually feed the children and go out into the garden and do things that you do at home. We're at home now, so we're at peace. We visited a couple of parks here. You know, we're able to do that now because we're not going to the parks by force now. We're going by choice. You know, When we leave the park, we actually have a home to come to.
You know, I'm just looking back over the places that you have been, Armega. The one thing that makes this home of yours in Tallahassee different from all the others is that you're working, Jason's working, you're paying for that house because you're both working. I wonder if that also gives you a greater strength of ownership because it's not charity. It's something that you guys are doing on your own.
Yes, to be able to pay our own bills now. I got a bill in the mail from Geico. We have car insurance for the first time in 4 years. You know?
Welcome to the world of the little envelopes with the tissue windows in them.
Yeah. So, I mean,
I can't imagine. I don't think I've ever talked to anyone who was happy to see the car insurance bill arrive, you know?
The car insurance, light bill, water bill, gas bill. We have a gas bill even, you know? Beyond the car gas bill, we have gas in the house, you know. So and even that, pulling up to the gas pump and the gas prices now are outrageous and we're able to put gas in our car to get us from point A to point B when before we'd have to just park our vehicle and walk. No other options.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Armega's son, Dua, is still a preschooler. I asked her to tell me how he was settling in. Well, turns out he was listening in on our conversation all along.
Dua, he's always joyous, you know. He's never really, said, you know, been like in a slum, like, oh, depressed, we don't have a place to stay. When we got the house, he said, Mom, I like this house, I like the hotel house, and I like that yellow house we had in Miami. He's so thankful and so grateful, you know, for even the smallest things in life. He gets up in the morning and goes out to his garden where he grows his vegetables and, you know, he helps plant the flowers. He's helped till the soil. He has his own time and space to grow with his vegetables and flowers in his garden and thing, you know. So,
Mommy, it's my turn now. It's my turn.
Who are you getting ready to talk to? Who are you getting ready to talk to?
A nursery.
Dua, it's Dick Gordon here. Can you hear me?
Sure.
I hear from your mother that you have a brand new home.
Yeah. My home is nice. It's blue. It's my blue house home.
Blue on the outside, right?
Yeah. White on the inside.
Dua, why do you like this house?
You know why? Because I do. I can play like fun games and just new ones, like good games. My favorite thing for me to do is play games on my laptop.
Wow, you have a laptop now.
Yeah, it's a computer one. And it has mouse and it has white batteries sometimes.
And can you spell your name on it?
Yeah, D-U-A, Dua.
Dua.
That's how I spell it.
And your mother was telling me that you also have your own garden.
Yeah, I do. I have it in my backyard. You know, Mommy was planting some bulbs in the front yard in my blue house. I'm planting some sunflower seeds in my garden. They're just not growing yet.
Do you check them every morning?
Yep, I like to check every morning.
And do you eat food that comes from your own garden?
Yeah, but not just any kind of food, just real food. Every type of things I like to eat. You know why? Because I like to eat something like fruit and vegetables. You know what's my favorite thing about fruits? My favorite thing about fruits is sometimes I like to eat watermelon, cantaloupe, and all that type of stuff.
Dua, how old are you?
I'm 4 years old.
It sounds to me like you're very, very settled in your new home. You're happy there.
Yeah, not special happy, just real happy. It's nice to have a home when I like to get it. Guess what? I'm going to buy me a real horse car. And it's a Mustang and it's red.
A Mustang? A car?
Yeah.
Big enough to get inside it?
Yup, big, real big. My mommy and daddy gonna buy it for me.
Thank you for talking with me.
All right, you're welcome.
It was nice to meet you.
It was nice to meet you, too.
You have fun in that blue house of yours, okay?
All right. Bye-bye.
That's Dua Tafare. His mother, Armega, says her son's cheery outlook on life is something that she and her husband, Jason, have helped to shape by surrounding him with a sense of well-being, even when they were living in the family car.
You have to show the children which way to go, you know? If he's seeing us around the house pouting and frowning and, you know, always sulking, then of course that would be his characteristic, you know? We can't allow those things, you know, to suffocate, you know? Like, I guess the average child, you would expect them to, I don't know, what do they have, nightmares and things of that nature if they're going through traumatic situations? But not this one. He'll always try to find a positive outlet. It's never dull. It's never dull.
Armega and Dua Tafare talked with me from their new hometown in Tallahassee.
The only thing we have to fear is...
I'm asking each of you to be pioneers towards...
Vice President, it has such a nice...
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
And we as a people will get to the promised land.
Yesterday in the story, I was talking with Andy Shapiro about the recent boom in what's called the youth vote. Well, Andy Shapiro had his political awakening when he became a self-confessed Deaniac, and this was back during the 2003 rise of Howard Dean.
You have the power to take this country back. You have the power. Thank you very much.
As corny as it is, and I hate to say it, but that whole line of, you know, just you have the power definitely struck me. The ability to change the world politically, but also the ability to sort of change yourself. And I know that probably wasn't what he was going for, but I sort of took it that way, getting sort of personal power over my life and sort of who I was and who I was becoming.
And so now the so-called youth vote in this campaign can focus its attention on the candidate who's attracted a considerable amount of their attention. Barack Obama has the delegates that he says he needs to claim the spot as the presumptive nominee for the Democratic Party. Well, as his story plays out in the headlines and as we continue to follow what's going to happen with Hillary Clinton, I'm interested in knowing about the political stories that have changed your life. Those moments of personal awakening or realization. The first time you voted. That first sniff of power, good or bad. The kinds of unusual encounters that sometimes come through politics. I am, as always, looking for ways to make the political personal. And I need your help for that. So go to our website at thestory.org and leave me a couple of notes about what's happened to you, or leave me a message on the phone at 1-888-966-9862. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.